Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tyranny of the minority in the US Senate, who yesterday acted on behalf of a vocal minority, the NRA, that represents 1% of the population, thwarting the will of 90% of Americans. Joining us is Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic, where he has an article, Did Our Founders Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control, the Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate. Then we'll look into the massive deadly explosion in Texas at a fertilizer plant that was last inspected by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration 28 years ago in 1985, when they found five serious violations and fined West Fertilizer $30. Keith Wrightson, the worker safety and health advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joins us to discuss the understaffed OSHA, whose measly budget of $558 million oversees the workplace deaths of 4,500 Americans per year, while hundreds of billions more is spent combating terrorists who since 9/11 have killed 238 Americans, an average of 24 per year. Then finally, we'll examine the new report, the Task Force on Detainee Treatment, by the Bipartisan Constitutional Project, that calls upon the nation to avoid the mistake of seeking revenge through human rights violations, as was done after 9/11. Mark Danner, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, and the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, joins us. And joining us now is Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, Did Our Founders Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alec McGillis.
Thanks for having me.
And at this point, the pictures that we spent most of yesterday waiting for from the FBI briefing that didn't happen have been posted of the two suspects that may be associated with the bombing in Boston. You also wrote the other day at the New Republic about the irony that Homeland Security's, where it does its explosive investigations, is there at Northeastern University and was closed on the very day. My understanding, just before we get into the gun control issue, because it is actually associated with the NRA,
right,
is that the NRA were the ones that stopped the ATF efforts to put what they call taggants in explosives, which are markers which help in forensic investigations of explosions. Just as they've thwarted gun control, apparently they've also thwarted efforts to track those who use explosives.
No, I saw that same report. You're right. There's a long-running battle between the NRA and the ATF. We don't have a director, a confirmed director of the ATF. Haven't had one for some time, largely because of opposition that the NRA has to the entire organization and its mission.
Which, at this point, it would be real helpful, would it not, to know, although it looks as though maybe these were improvised explosives. They certainly were improvised explosive devices.
Right.
But the idea that any domestic terrorism involving explosives found in the United States or purchased or stolen in the United States cannot be traced because of the NRA is pretty egregious under the present circumstances.
It's pretty remarkable. It's not, although I guess some would say that it's not necessarily all that much more remarkable than the troubles they've posed for tracing, guns used in major gun crimes. So,
which, of course, is the Tyhart Amendment that forbids the ATF and any law enforcement agency sharing information about gun crimes,
right,
weapons that have already killed and maimed people found at crime scenes. So let's talk about what you've been writing about, though, and the day that the president said was a shameful day in Washington when the efforts, these modest, watered-down efforts at gun control involving improving background checks on weapons purchases didn't even get debated because of the filibuster threshold of 60. Is that, before we get into your arguments about the tyranny of small states in the undemocratic Senate, that's in itself an extraordinary usurpation of power, is it not? The use of the...
The filibuster, no yeah. Question. I mean, I think that's really where this discussion has to start, is with the filibuster and the fact that it's that it's now just completely accepted and completely routine that you need those 60 votes, a supermajority. They had their 54 votes yesterday, and that's a majority, and that was not enough. There was an attempt, you know, just a few months ago, to try to weaken the filibuster, and it was even that attempt. There was a pretty incremental reform, but that was let drop. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, did not push it as hard as he might have, and there was, of course, great resistance from Mitch McConnell on the other side. So there was that chance, that window, to try to do something about this filibuster, and they missed that. So now, once again, we have something that had 54 votes, a majority of senators, and it does not go anywhere.
So in terms of the votes themselves, the 54, there were four Democrats who voted with the Republicans who almost unanimously voted against it. Those four being Mark Begich from Alaska, Arkansas's Mark Pryor, Max Baucus of Montana, and Heidi Heinkamp of North Dakota. Interesting enough, four Republicans voted for it. So right. I guess they level each other out. Let's talk about the idea that Heidi Heinkamp comes from a state that has a population of 700,000, which is smaller than cities like Columbus, Fort Worth, and Charlotte, yet is able to have such critical influence over this gun debate, where they may be free in small states to wield weapons, but most of the victims of weapons are in urban areas, and they tend to have the red states have the disproportionate political power than those that are essentially the victims of gun violence. Is that how it's working out in America?
Oh, completely. I mean, there's no other issue probably where the sort of hegemony of the small states in the Senate, in small rural states, comes to bear as much as with gun control. I mean, it is simply extraordinary, and it cannot be stated enough that it's extraordinary that North Dakota has two votes in the Senate, has 700,000 people. It's as large, as you said, as what we think of as mid-sized cities like Columbus and Fort Worth. It's smaller than your average congressional district, and it has two senators, which is as many as, of course, as California does, with vastly, vastly more people. It's just remarkable, and it's an issue like guns where this really comes through. That said, I do think we should add that we should not let these senators sort of off the hook on this vote simply because they come from small rural states and face a sort of a different culture back home. The fact is that some senators, some Democrats from red-leaning rural states did vote for the gun law yesterday, including some people right next door to Heidi Heitkamp. Tim Johnson from South Dakota, he voted for it. John Tester from Montana, he voted for it. But Max Baucus and Heidi Heitkamp did not. So these were decisions that each of these people made, and we should always keep that in mind and not just sort of allow them to sort of ascribe it to their geographic happenstance.
So this disparity where you have 38 million people who live in the 22 smallest states represented by 44 senators, comparing it here to the state of California where you have 38 million Californians represented by two, this, of course, is in the very foundation of the country, and it's often brought up in terms of the Electoral College. But my understanding is at this point, there have been a lot of efforts on the part of Democrats to suggest the Electoral College should be reformed because it went against them in Florida in 2000. But it looks as if the Electoral College actually went against the Republicans in the last election.
It probably did in the last election. I think we shouldn't be, should be careful not to muddy the debate between the Electoral College and the Senate, because if you step back and look at it, the Electoral College has its own inequities and own problems, which is that someone can, as happened to Al Gore, of course, you can win a majority of the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. But the fact is that the Electoral College is still vastly more rational, really, than the Senate, in the sense that South Dakota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming have way, 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 way fewer Electoral College votes than does California or New York or Texas. Yet they have, in the Senate, they have the exact same say. And that is just so extraordinary. And it's something that simply could not, I don't think that the founders, we should hold the founders to account for having come up with this deal that they had. At the same time, we have to realize that they surely had no idea what what it was setting up for themselves. The fact is, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, when they came up with this compromise for how to set up the Congress, the largest state of the original 13, Virginia, at the time, was about 11 or 12 times larger than the smallest one, which was Delaware. So they said, okay, we're going to give everyone two seats in the Senate. We'll have the House be done by population, but the Senate will everyone get two. We now have a situation where the largest state, California, is 66 times larger than the smallest one, Wyoming. So you have these disparities that have just grown vastly larger. In some sense, the responsibility maybe falls to the Congresses of the 19th century as we were growing across the country. And when they decided to basically divvy up these vast open spaces into multiple states, none of which have grown, many of which have not grown all that much since. And so you have two Dakotas, for instance. Dakota Territory got broken into two different states. So the Dakotas, you know, which together just have, you know, about as many people as, you know, say Philadelphia, are now two states with four senators, twice the say as California. It's really pretty remarkable.
Again, I'm speaking with Alec MacGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. And previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, "Did Our Founding Fathers' Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate." So turning back to the undemocratic Senate and yesterday's shameful day in Washington, as the president said, but it wasn't so long ago, was it, Alec, that senators were appointed by state legislatures, which led to enormous corruption because a lot of these legislatures were owned by the railroad companies, and it was only reformed by, what was it, the 15th or 17th Amendment?
Right. Yes, and it's interesting. You know, I think this is there are two. The Senate, as originally conceived, was undemocratic in two ways. And there was the fact that it was apportioned two per state, not by population. And there was the fact that it was set up; it was not directly elected by the people. And that the latter problem was fixed. The thing is, I think these two things are often conflated, in the sense that people, when I bring up this point about the Senate's apportionment being just crazily undemocratic, you have a lot of people say to you, "Ah, but James Madison wanted it this way. This was this whole idea of us being a republic, not a mass mob democracy. You needed to have the Senate to be a little bit removed from the mass of the people." And that's true. Madison wanted the Senate to be sort of a level higher than the House, away from the masses, but he did not want the Senate to be apportioned two per state. He thought that was wrong. He thought that they should be apportioned by population. Madison was in favor of the non-direct election of the Senate. That was part of his whole notion. He was not in favor of having it divvied up the way it was. He was from Virginia, a big state, and he thought it was only proper that Virginia should have more of a say in the Senate than Delaware or Rhode Island. And it was only because of the horse trading that had to happen at the Constitutional Convention that we came up with the so-called Connecticut Compromise, which was that the House would be apportioned by population, but the Senate would not.
So you're not in any way they're letting off the White House on this, are you, Alec? Because I think there is some criticism that's due to their tactics. They seem to have waited too long after Newtown. They had a commission that made recommendations that, you know, you could have – we already knew everything that they were saying. I don't know why they needed a commission, why they didn't act sooner. Why they loaded this thing up with the assault weapons ban, which then gave the NRA the huge opening to say they're going to take away our guns. If they would have started out with a more modest approach, they would have ended up with something as opposed to nothing.
Well, you can definitely do some armchair quarterbacking. I think there's a case to be made that they did wait maybe a little bit too long. Although, you know, the fact is, if they'd really tried to jump on it right away and push something through in the heat of the moment, you might have had some senators saying, you know, using procedure as an excuse not to act, saying, no, look, we're not going to push something like this through. We need to take our time and think about it. You might not have had the development of this quite remarkable alliance between Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey, two senators from very, pro-gun rights states. who were willing to come together around the background check thing. Yes, there are definitely things the White House could have done differently and better. Still, I think at the end of the day, we should not lose sight of who was responsible for this failing yesterday, which is senators. Senators who, both conservative red state Democrats and Republicans, who you might have expected to cross over and support this, but decided not to. And this is a decision that they faced. Some of their colleagues decided that they would take the chance. They would take the chance to face down the NRA and vote for this relatively, you know, measured and incremental reform. But a whole bunch of them decided that they were not up to that. And that's really where I think at the end of the day that the accountability needs to lie.
But how much of it is a case, Alec MacGillis, of the squeaky wheels gets the oil, in as much as why were those senators intimidated by the NRA, who in the last election cycle spent $25 million and had about the worst results of all lobbying groups? And obviously the senators, I think, don't want to rile up the gun fanatics in this country who are very active. So it raises the question of the disparity between the passion of the pro-gun people and the transient nature of the outrage that the gun control people feel following these repetitive massacres that take place in this country.
Right. No, there's definitely there's this old, we much discussed, intensity gap. In the last few weeks, you'd hear so many senators rationalizing their decision by saying, "Well, look, I'm getting a lot of calls from gun rights people in my state urging me to not do this. I'm just getting a lot of calls from them." And you sort of think in response to that, well, of course you are. They're a well-organized lobby. They have their members call. And you can sort of chide the senators for overvaluing the minority of people who are making those calls to them, when in fact polls suggest that, you know, the huge majorities of their voters are just perfectly fine with this legislation. But you could of course also argue that the gun control side, you know, needs to do a better job of just keeping up that kind of basic pressure. But I do think that there's a level in which the some of these congressmen and senators do overestimate the power of this lobby, and I think it's over the years there's this sort of legend that's built up, and I think the media's had a role in it. We've sort of constantly repeat that the Democrats got badly hurt for taking up gun control, that they got hurt in 1994 and 2000, that their losses in those years were ascribed to gun control, when in fact, if you look more closely at them, it's really questionable whether gun control played as large a role in some of those losses as people now think. So we've kind of built up this notion of this all-powerful NRA, and every time, you know, a senator ducks like they did yesterday, it kind of only adds to that legend.
Well, but some of the more strident people in the Senate, not to mention the people that we're talking about, the pro-gun people that lobby their legislators and the NRA encourages and the gun manufacturers finance, you know, you've got people like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Rand Paul, of course, has said the other day that all of these people from Newtown are being used as props. He was very callous, you know, and he's a guy that threatened to filibuster. You got Ted Cruz saying outrageous things. What I find extraordinary in this country, that people on the far right can say incredibly incendiary, irresponsible, dangerous, sometimes completely crackpot things, and they don't get pulled over. I don't understand how our polity has become so poisonous.
Well, that's certainly true. But I got to say, after this week, what I'm finding myself thinking more about are people like people who have shown themselves to be, you know, relatively reasonable on other issues, and people that Democrats can work with, who couldn't bring themselves to vote for this. When you have to think that in their heart of hearts, they saw that it was a completely sensible reform to close these loopholes in the background checks. I'm thinking of people like Rob Portman, the Ohio Republican, Bob Corker and Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, Kelly Ayotte, New Hampshire, this relatively junior senator from New Hampshire. She's a former attorney general from New Hampshire, very, you know, sort of law and order type, good attorney general up there. I covered her when I was in my earlier years reporting up there, and she was, you know, a tough prosecutor, and for her to now decide not to vote to expand the background checks to make sure that felons can't buy guns, you know, I think that's really where the focus needs to lie now, and on people who just decided to duck on this when some of their colleagues in also in tough states had the gumption to vote for it.
Well, just in closing, Alec McGillis, I spoke recently with the political scientist Amitai Etzioni, who makes the argument that there's a different way to look at this, particularly in the Senate, and that is that there are really two parties in the United States, not the Democrats and the Republicans, but the conservatives and the liberals, and that the conservatives simply dominate, and that the liberals are in the minority, and that all of the important legislation that goes against the White House or compromises the White House in the way that the initial stimulus bill was, the health care bill was. If you look at the DNA, and you got people like Max Baucus who voted against the gun control, that's how they always join the Republican majority. So it's these red state Democrats who really are a part of the conservative party as opposed to the Democratic Party.
Right. I mean, you have to be careful not to overgeneralize, because on some issues, of course, you know, such as on you know, say the healthcare law, and maybe some tax issues and fiscal stuff, you'll get the Max Baucus or Heidi Heitkamp on your side. No, but on this one, they really saw their geography as a handy excuse to duck on this, even though some of their colleagues from these same states, you know, thought that they could pull it off. I mean, the fact that Joe Manchin led the way on this legislation. I mean, Joe Manchin's from West Virginia, which is, you know, as got as many, you know, guns per capita as anywhere. And this is a guy who shot a gun at the cap and trade carbon emissions bill a few years ago for a campaign ad to show how tough and in tune with West Virginia he was. And he had the guts to take this on and lead the way on this bill. And he's just standing strong now, and he says he's going to carry on with it, and he's being really quite eloquent in explaining the need for this and calling to account his colleagues who just didn't have what it took to stand up for it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alec McGillis.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, "Did Our Founders' Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate." We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the massive explosion in Texas.